Good morning, everybody. It's Jim Bianco. It is Thursday, February 21st, and this is our monthly conference call. A little bit of housekeeping up front. As usual, there was a handout. It did go out a little bit late last night. It's called Credit Monolines and Auditors Updating the Credit Crisis. It should have been a link in all of the emails that we sent around, and hopefully everybody's got it. If you don't, you can send a email to Ryan Malo in our office at rmalo at biancoresearch.com, and he'll turn right around and send you email with an attached PDF on it. Okay, the topic that we've had for the last several months, which continues to dominate the financial markets, is the latest with the credit crisis. In this month's presentation, what I'd like to do is talk about the losses in the banking system to date, the cause for the losses in the banking system, which is a nice way of saying, let's talk about the state of housing, because the state of housing seems to be driving everything in valuations in housing and in structured finance. I want to discuss a little bit about the monolines and what's happening there with the monolines, and just to give you a sense of where I'm going with the monoline discussion, I'm in the camp that Bill Ackman seems to be about the only guy that's doing anything credible at that. I know it's incredible to say that the short seller is the only guy that's got credible plans. Warren Buffett's trying to steal them. Eric Dinello appears to be not knowing what he's doing. He changes his mind every day on what he wants to do. And he's being driven by the politics of Elliott Spitzer, which I'll get into in a second. As far as credit goes, I want to show a couple of charts on credit spreads and just quick remarks there. The worst of the credit market, is this week. It has not been, a month ago like stocks have been. So the credit markets are not showing any signs of relief. And the auditor side of the equation. A couple of days ago, Diamond, who is the chairman of Barclays, the other Diamond, Bob Diamond, who is the chairman of Barclays, said, in effect, that he's holding his breath over the next couple of weeks because all the 10-Ks are coming out. Auditors have a keen memory of what happened to Arthur Andersen after Enron. When Enron had problems, the first thing we did was we liquidated the auditing firm, and then we asked, okay, what was the problem? In the last 10 days, we've seen Credit Suisse and AIG run into what is believed to be problems with their auditors and have to take sizable write-downs. Credit Suisse, it's not at all clear, but the belief is that their auditors were the driving force behind the marks that their credit desk had and causing the $2.85 billion loss. Bob Diamond's comment is that everybody's thinking that there might be more of these little surprises to come as we move forward from here, and that the fear is that we're going to have a lot more of them. And then finally, I want to talk a little bit about stocks and talk about why those that think that the stock market has been beaten up or destroyed in this market, it's not the case at all. If you are of the opinion that this is going to be a secular bear market, it's pretty much right on track. So let me start at some page 2. Banking system losses through February 19th. Here's a wonderful little table that I found from Deutsche Bank, which details all of the losses to date, broken out by U.S. banking companies in the top and global banking companies in the bottom. Total loss column in the center. If you look towards the bottom, you'll see that we're at about $200 billion to date. It also gives you a size of their subprime exposures. Non-U.S. banking systems have not reported those numbers, but you can get a sense of how big the subprime exposures are. And then I think they're correct in putting the leveraged loan exposures in the last column to show you that there's still $262 billion worth of leveraged loans outstanding. Has anybody noticed now that the sign of a private equity firm's acumen and talent is now in their ability to use their material adverse change clause or their MAC clause to weasel out of deals as opposed to actually making deals? And we've seen this with KKR and with J.C. Flowers. And if that is indeed the case, that they're so brilliant because they can figure out ways to weasel out of deals, that leverage loan exposure of $262 billion could also become an issue as well from here as we move forward. One other thought for you here. This table does break down third quarter and fourth quarter numbers, and you'll see that in the third quarter, the total losses were $50 billion. I'm looking at the bottom under global total, and in the fourth quarter, the losses were $129 billion. The first quarter so far, the losses are 10. Does that mean it's getting better? Well, I went back and I looked at some of my notes from about 7 weeks into the first quarter. In other words, I looked at my notes from the end of November, and I looked at my notes from the end of August, and we weren't expecting anything even in the ballpark of $10 billion of losses at that point. Remember that it was January that the stock market really took it hard because the losses really weren't even understood to come in anywhere near $129 billion until after the quarter ended. So I wouldn't look at that early number at $10 billion and say that it's suggesting one way or another if the quarter is going to be worse or better. It's still way too early to tell. Chart on page 3, I won't go through. They also included some notes about the charges and some of the assumptions that they made for coming up with those numbers. So I decided to include them as well, and I included them on a second page so it was blown up big enough so you can actually read it, so you can go through that at your leisure. Table on page 4. Table on page 4 I get from Bloomberg, and they said that they would have this updated by the end of the week, and as of an hour ago, it was still not updated. But it shows total capital raised at least through January 31st. So the banking system has lost about $200 billion in capital during this credit crisis. They've raised, according to at least the numbers through January 31st, about $84 billion. Put these numbers in perspective. The total amount of capital in the banking system worldwide, and I read this in an article in the FT about 2 weeks ago, is about $1.5 trillion. So we're looking at right now that the total losses that the banking system has suffered has been about 15% of worldwide capital, which is an unbelievable number. I would argue that you might have to go back to the Great Depression to find the last time that the banking system lost this much capital in less than a year. And if you net it against the total capital raised to offset those losses, it's around 7% in a year. And I still would argue you probably have to go back to the Great Depression or if not the 1970s to find another time that the banking system has lost this much money in this short of a time period. Chart on page 5, I can't emphasize this enough, and I guess my emphasis of this comes from the idea that I don't hear enough people saying this. This chart here shows median existing home sales on the top chart. This is existing home sales, not the overall number that we typically show, and it shows the year-over-year change in the bottom. The chart goes back to 1968. And you can see that the current period is the first time in 40 years that existing home sales have declined on a year-over-year basis. The assumption that was built in to all of the purchases of structured securities collateralized by home equity loans was that home prices don't go down. And if you measure it on existing home sales, here's 40 years of history where they never went down on a year-over-year basis. The closest we came was essentially zero in January of 1991. The last plot, December 31st, 2007, shows that they had declined and 4% from a year ago earlier levels. And if you turn the page on page 6, this shows you the Case-Shiller index on the top. The blue line is the year-over-year change, and the red line is the quarterly change. And the OFAO index, the Office of Financial Home Enterprise Oversight, which is the regulator of Fannie and Freddie. It shows their home price index as well. It's a quarterly number, so it's still through September. They should be putting out the December number soon. But let me focus on Case-Shiller. It is also down. It is down a lot more. It's down by 8.42%. Case-Shiller is a measure of existing home sales, but what they try and do is they try and normalize it for concessions, and it's just in the cities. So they're looking at the big cities as opposed to everything, which is the urban areas have been hurt worse than rural or suburban areas when it comes to the home price decline, which is why Case-Shiller is showing a bigger decline. Bob Shiller was talking about this index, and he said that he believes that right now the home price market is the worst it's been since the Great Depression, or he actually said World War II, but I'm saying back it up 10 more years and you've got the Great Depression. Nobody wants to use that word because it's so inflammatory to say it is the worst since the Great Depression, but the fact is It is. And that's not a forecast. That is a statement of fact that we have the worst home price market in 70 years. How else do you wipe out 15% of banking capital worldwide unless you have something along those lines, the worst home price market in 70 years? And it is because the belief was that home prices would never go down, that there was no such thing as a reckless loan, because collateral underlying home prices would always rise and always bail you out of no matter what kind of a deal or structure you bought. Chart on page 7, Case-Shiller also has a yearly index that goes back to 1890s. And what I wanted to point out here is that the biggest home price decline ever was 1925 to 1933. It went down 30%. We are currently about 10% off of the highs that were set in somewhere in July or to September of 2006, depending on which measure you use. We're back at levels that we saw in home prices on the national indices that were equivalent to the first quarter of 2005. And yes, this is the biggest decline that we've seen since the Great Depression, where it went down 30%. Now, a lot of people have pointed out, if you look at the bottom chart, if you take that top chart and you deflate it by CPI, you see we had a massive run-up in prices, in real home prices, between 1997 and 2006. And the argument there is, well, they were just correcting a big run-up in prices, and even if we went down 30%, like we did during the Great Depression, we'd only be at 2003 prices. That is true. However, the market did not view it that way, because after the big run-up, we still levered ourselves to home prices never going down, which is why 10% down has produced $200 billion in losses. So if you look at the bottom chart as a justification for why prices are going down and maybe should have gone down, and then you conclude they're going to go down more, and economy.com, Mark Zandi's firm, is now out with, you know, they're going to go down at least 20%, and S&P and Moody's are using that as their base assumption in valuing CDOs. So 20% down, so we're only halfway through the home price decline right now, seems to be a consensus forecast for the moment. And you use this chart, yes, that's why home prices are going down. They got over, we overshot them on the upside, but nevertheless, if they continue to go down, they are going to continue to wreak havoc on the financial system as we move forward from here. How much further do they have to go down before they become affordable? That's the charts on page 8. Here is the affordability index. The top chart on the, is the monthly plot for the National Association of Realtors Housing Affordability Index, and I put some lines on for averages and standard deviations, and we still seem to be a little bit below average. And the bottom chart shows a yearly plot of it going back to 1970. You can see that while home prices were the most unaffordable that they had been since the mid-1980s, back in 2006, they were a lot more unaffordable in 1982. What I want to point out about this index, and this is why the slide is titled The Problem with the Affordability Indexes, is that the affordability indexes are, they have some flaws. They assume that the borrower can always make a 20% down payment and that the maximum mortgage payment is 25% of a household's grossly income. That's a standard that is not used today. And because of that standard, what really drives the affordability indexes is the level of interest rates more than anything else. Why were homes so unaffordable in 1982? Because by this measure, it was because of sky-high interest rates that caused that to happen. Now, that's why we got in trouble in the first place. We started to price homes to monthly cash flows, and we started to use creative financing techniques like negative amortization loans and subprime teasers to lower monthly cash flows to get people into homes. We did not price homes basis their underlying fundamental, and the underlying fundamentals would be income. If you jump to page 10, let me jump us to page 10 for a second, and I'll come back to page 9 in a second. Here is a broad measure of home price valuation based on income. It shows the total value of real estate in the United States, which is about $23.25 trillion, divided by personal income over the previous 12 months, which is about $10.25 trillion, or a ratio of 226%. And you can see that as of the end of September, this number was still grossly overinflated, meaning that the price of homes relative to the underlying income was still much higher than we've seen in the past, and we still got a long way to come down. The affordability indexes have been plugging the gap by trying to say that lower interest rates will be the plug to fix that. But again, that's what got us into trouble. Now, if you go back to page 9 is the table we've used quite a bit, pushing on a string. The Fed has cut the funds rate by 225 basis points. The odds that we get a 50 basis point cut at the March 18th meeting are 100% right now. Is there anything we're starting to price in the possibility of another 75 basis points? So we're at 225. We look like we're about to go to 275. And if you look at the bottom of the table, the numbers for interest rates, mortgage rates, have hardly moved. Jumbo rate mortgages are higher now than when the Fed started to cut rates. They're higher now than when we were at 5.25. Home loans are unchanged since we were at 5.25. And conforming mortgages are down less than 50 basis points. Even though the funds rate's down 225 and the 10-year's down 120, they're down less than 50. And adjustable rate mortgages, which would typically follow the funds rate, is only down by 52 basis points. So this idea that we're going to get interest rate relief to help everybody get homes more affordable, that's what got us into trouble in the first place. But more importantly, the reason that we are not getting interest rate relief despite the Fed's cut in rates, those interest rates aren't coming down. Yes, LIBOR is coming down. That is helping with the resets, but I'll touch upon that in a minute. But interest rates aren't coming down. Now, the reason is, and I think you can see this on the chart on page 11. The chart on page 11, asset-backed security issuance disappears. This is Bloomberg data. The top chart shows asset-backed issuance, top left chart that is, on page 11, asset-backed issuance by home equity loans. Between the end of 2003 and the beginning of 2007, we averaged about 40 ABS deals a month backed by home equity loans. November was zero, December was two, January was two, February zero. So in the last 4 months now, we've done four deals. We did 40 a month when we were in the heyday between 2003 and 2007. The bottom chart shows the same thing, asset-backed deals. This is subprime. And you could see that we've really dropped off to almost zero on that chart as well. Now, if you look at the chart on the right, this shows the size of the asset-backed market and how in the blue bars it's grown from $12 billion in May of 2002 to $732 billion in May of 2007. So we did a lot of deals during that period when home prices were running up right at the high, so that when home prices start having their worst correction since the Great Depression, we seem to be having all these losses. Now, something interesting has been happening in the last couple of weeks, and let me start with the chart on page 12, deals underwater. All the, as I mentioned, July of 2006 is when median existing home sale prices peaked. They're about 10% off their high. They're about at the same level that they were in March of 2005. The upper left chart on page 7 shows that since March of 2005, we've had 1,167 asset-backed deals with a total value of $645 billion done. And on a national basis, home prices have no equity gain during the pricing of those 1,167 deals with $645 billion worth of assets. If you look at the chart in the lower left, it shows the growth of the ABS index backed by home equity loans. This is the Merrill Lynch data, and I mark March of 2005, and I mark July of 2006. March of 2005 is where we're at in prices right now on a national basis. July of 2006 is the peak that we had in terms of prices. So you can see that we've done a tremendous number of deals, that there is no equity in those homes. Now on page 13, will 2008's buzzword be walk away? I've talked a lot about this in our News Clips product. I talked a little bit about this in our conference call last month. I think this is if I was to give this the title of the biggest story that nobody is talking about, it could very well be walkaways. And what's happening here is I think that, first of all, to bring you up to date on something that's happened in the last couple of days, the Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson announced last week that there was this group of mortgage servicers called the Hope Now Alliance that was going to put a 30-day freeze on mortgages, on foreclosures. And on Tuesday, that was extended to Fannie and Freddie and basically every servicer in the country so that for the next 30 days, there will be no foreclosures in the United States, or at least that's their goal. They want to call everybody, and they want to find out what they can do to help. What I think is happening is when they did the teaser freezer plan last November and October, it was for people with subprime mortgages that were going to get reset higher that had 3% equity or less or a 97% loan-to-value LTV. I think they called those people, and they basically told them that they weren't going to pay unless their home price started going up and that they get it. It's a rational response by homeowners. I bought this home on extreme leverage, put no money down. I expected it to make me money. It's losing me money. If I sell it, I actually have to write a check at closing. I'm not interested in continuing to make these mortgages. I've only been here 2 years. I haven't got that emotional attachment that you would if you've had in your house for 15 years. And they're willing to walk away. And I think that they got scared that there is an epidemic of walkaways. Bank of America, Wachovia have talked about this. Moody's and Fitch have reworked their CDO models to include higher potentials of walkaways. Yesterday, the OTS, the Office of Thrift Supervision, said that they were developing a plan aimed at preventing an avalanche of mortgage borrowers walking away from homes that are worth less than they owe. And I'm reading from the first sentence of their press release that they put out yesterday. I think that what they're very, very worried about right now is that people aren't paying voluntarily. Now, the problem with this is that nobody calls up their mortgage broker or their servicer and says, I decided I'm not going to pay anymore. Go ahead, start foreclosure procedures. I know it'll take you about 8 months to kick me out of here. And the day before the sheriff shows up for the keys, I'll just have the moving trucks take my stuff and we'll go rent somewhere. Nobody says that, but that's what they're fearing that they're actually doing right now. Again, we have a lot of non-recourse laws in this country that make it very borrower-friendly. The idea behind the non-recourse laws was that if the lender knew that the only way he was going to get paid back was to make a sane loan at a reasonable valuation to somebody who was going to pay him back, that would prevent reckless lending practices. Well, we still got the reckless lending practices, but we also have a set of laws that makes it relatively easy to walk away from your home without getting your wages garnished or having anybody come after you. Yes, it can ruin your credit rating, but you could still work around that as well, too. Better to ruin your credit rating than to pay $50,000 to get out of a home that you're underwater, and that seems to be the argument that they're making. So I think that this fear that we have right now that there's going to be massive numbers of walkaways is very real, and it's not measurable because you can't do an econometric formula that says based on somebody's FICO score and their income that they could pay but they've elected not to. You don't know enough to know that. So no, there's no possible way we can have data for it, but the circumstantial evidence is big, and it's got the Office of Thrift Supervision and the Treasury Secretary worried very much. I don't think the market understands this, and I think that as we move forward from here, this could be the next worry point for the marketplace, is not only are home prices falling, but CDO and mortgage losses are going to be accelerated through the advent of the walkaway. In the last few minutes, let me turn tack here a little bit and talk about the monoline insurers, page 14. These pie charts that I have on page 14 come from the British Bankers Association. They show who are the buyers of protection and who are the sellers of protection in the CDS market, in the credit default swap market. If you look at the big blue part of it, banks, their buyers are 51% and their sellers are 38%. Banks are net buyers of protection. If you look at the pink part, the securities houses, brokerage firms or investment banks, they're net buyers of protection. In the dark blue part, hedge funds, they're net buyers of protection. Who are the big net sellers of protection? The monoline insurers and their close cousins, the reinsurers. They have collectively net sold 25% of all credit default swap contracts outstanding. The plan that have them split is what we have termed the worst case scenario. And as a quick aside, what's happened here since August is that whenever a problem comes about, I think we're about 4 for 4 now that the worst case scenario seems to play out in all these instances. First, we had the problem with the structured investment vehicles or the SIVs, and then we had the MLAC or the super SIV bailout. It never worked. The worst case scenario was all the banks did take them on their balance sheets, and they did take losses, and a lot of these went insolvent. So we tried to bail out the SIVs. We wound up with the worst case scenario. We tried to freeze subprime teaser rates so that they wouldn't be ratcheted higher and cause a wave of foreclosures. We got the worst case scenario. Everybody's walking away from their home right now, and now we're trying to freeze foreclosures across the United States for the next 30 days to prevent an avalanche of people from walking away from their home. The worst case scenario is playing out there in Hank Paulson's other plan. As far as the monoline insurers go, the whole idea here was to try and not let the banking system wind up with hundreds of billions of dollars of losses. Barclays estimates it'd be $143. UBS estimates it'd be $203 billion of losses if the monolines were to go insolvent. Oppenheimer says it could be $70 billion between Merrill City and UBS alone. What this split plan is setting up to do is exactly the worst-case scenario. It is going to bail out the municipal side of the business by essentially bankrupting the structured side of the business. Now, as I mentioned, Bill Ackman put out a proposal 2 days ago, and in today's news clips, I actually have a link to his PowerPoint presentation. And what he suggests is if you're going to split these companies into two parts, instead of having the municipal side upstream all of its profits to the holding company, have the municipal side upstream all of its profits to the structured finance side. And only when the structured finance side has been fully satisfied and has their AAA rating can you send money back up to the holding company. Remember now, Ackman is short the holding company. He thinks that the holding companies are worth zero. His proposal is how do you bail out the insurance subsidiaries, and he has maintained all along that the insurance subsidiaries can be bailed out and can survive, but only if the holding companies wind up being worth nothing. And that seems to be where his proposal comes. And again, I have this sense that there's really not a good understanding of what's happening with the monolines and what's happening with all of these proposals. Eric DiNalo changes his tune every day on this thing. It's apparent to me in watching some of his conversations and reading what he was saying last week versus this week. Last week he was saying that their sole goal was to save the monoline insurers, and on a Bloomberg interview when they asked him what about the structured finance side, his comment was, I don't know what's going to happen with that side. Today he's saying, oh, no, the plan all along was to bail out both sides at the same time. I don't think he understood what he was saying last week, and I think he just had a quick education process in order to get there. The monolines are on course to have the worst-case scenario unfold and ratchet up the losses to the banking system. The banking system holds maybe $600 billion worth of guarantees from the monolines in the forms of municipals and structured finance, and if the structured finance is split off into its own insurance subsidiary and that gets a big haircut on its credit rating, or maybe that side goes insolvent, the banking system is sitting on huge losses. DiNalo works for Spitzer. Spitzer got a promotion to governor by screwing Merrill Lynch's research department, by screwing mutual fund timers, by ending Sandy Weill's career. So when Merrill and Citi go back to Spitzer and say, look, you can't split them up this way, you can't cause hundreds of billions of dollars worth of losses, his comment could very well be, well, the last time I stuck it to you, I became governor. If I stick it to you now, maybe I'll be the next president of the United States. It's going to fall on deaf ears. He got a promotion the last time he stuck it to Wall Street. And so I don't understand. I'd be very surprised if he shows any sympathy to them. Is it, on the other side, I've argued, Spitzer is getting a lot of calls, panic calls from town managers and mayors and project supervisors and school districts and park districts saying, we can't borrow, we can't borrow, we can't roll over our auction rate securities. This is a disaster. And Spitzer's thinking if he bails out the municipal side of the business, to have a couple of thousand politicians in your indebtedness is not a bad thing when you're the governor of New York. So I see this as going down the road of the worst case scenario right now, that we're going to wind up creating lots of losses for the banking system, making the situation worse, not better. Finally, the charts on page 15, credit up, stocks down, a rerun of August. Here shows you some charts on the credit spreads. The top spread shows you investment-grade spreads. We've actually made new highs since this chart was updated. Yesterday, we were at 240. That is the widest level we've been so far. The iTraxx crossover index made its wide on the 18th, 2 days ago. It hit 600 intraday. So that one has made a new wide as well, too. So credit spreads aren't getting any better. They're continuing to worsen. And if you jump to page 16, the red lines on page 16 are credit spreads plotted inversely, so they track stocks. What's been very clear in this environment is the stock market has been, if anything, a lagging indicator. There's been lots of lagging indicators to what's been happening here. First, credit goes down. The stock market doesn't understand the problem. That was July. Credit was getting destroyed. The stock market was making new all-time highs. Stock investors said, I don't know what the crossover index is, and I really don't care. But then in August, they did learn what it was in a big way. In November, the Wall Street Journal had big, huge stories about that the rating agencies were putting the monolines on downgrade watch and that this could be a crisis in the muni market. And I remember we wrote, why aren't muni guys paying attention to this? Maybe because it's either been discounted, again, there's that word again, or maybe insurance isn't worth what we think it was. 2 months later, all of a sudden, the auction rate securities market is panicking over downgrades. So to suggest that the monolines are having problems and to suggest that credit is not getting any better and it will eventually flow back and mean that the stock market is going to have problems, the economy is going to continue to have problems, is nothing more than to say, describe what has been the case in the last month. This has been unusual in that you can read some very bad news, you can think about it for a week, hold a meeting, do analysis on it, decide 2 weeks later that it's bad, get out of your position, and then a month later the market panics over the story that you were talking about for a month. We were always under the assumption that when bad news hit, it would probably be discounted in the market before the New York Stock Exchange opened the next day. Not in this crisis. Bad news hits, and it takes the market a month to understand it. And I think that this monoline split is the next bit of bad news that if it goes down the road that it's going down right now, it's the worst-case scenario. And the market, I don't think, gets it. And that for you could probably see that panic come. Page 17, commercial mortgages, is becoming another issue as well, too. What's happening here in terms of commercial mortgages is that the whole idea of structured finance is now starting to have problems. Leveraged loans are having problems. Commercial mortgages are having problems. No asset-backed deals backed by home loans or home mortgages are getting done. So the longer that this crisis continues, the worse it gets. Page 18 is a piece that we did last week. We talked about housing. If you look at the lower right chart, let me start there. Real estate jobs is a percentage of all jobs, roughly, just to use a round number, 10 or 11% of all the jobs in the United States are tied somewhere to real estate. And on that chart, there's a little table of the six types of jobs that I have defined as real estate. If you look at the upper left chart, since the end of the last recession in November of 2001, by September of 2006, we created 1.6 million real estate jobs. And interestingly, that was right when home prices peaked. And home prices have started back down, and we're at 1.3 million jobs right now, and we're at the lowest level since about early 2005. This cumulative real estate jobs created chart looks almost identical to a national home price chart like Case-Shiller or existing home sales. So basically, there's this big pull of jobs being created and now jobs being extinguished based on how real estate looks. And if you look at the bottom chart, the blue line shows the percentage of jobs created in this recovery that were tied to real estate. By June of 2006, it was one-third of all the jobs. We're down to 18% of all the jobs because we're getting rid of them. But remember, it's only about 11% of employment. So even now, we're still overweighted on real estate jobs relative to all jobs. Normally, the red line is the 1991 recovery. Normally, if real estate's 11% of jobs, it would have created 11% during the recovery. This one, while 11% of jobs, created 40% or 33% until home prices peaked, and now it's a giant drag on home prices as we move forward from here. So I think that another problem with home prices continuing to fall is you could almost say that's going to continue to put up negative payroll numbers as we get rid of all of these real estate jobs. We still have 1.3 million real estate jobs that we've created since December of 2001 that still exist. Finally, the last set of charts, I want to talk a little bit about the stock market, and I just want to throw out a couple of comments here. A lot of people are looking for catalysts. What's going to end this credit crisis? And a lot of people come to the conclusion that what's going to end the credit crisis is things like market indicators are going to tell you that things are getting better. And one of the big market indicators that everybody's looking at is, well, stocks bottomed on January 22nd. There's this belief that stocks lead and know all, although I would argue that it's demonstrable that stocks are the last thing to react in this market. It's, you know, I don't want to say it because I have not been of that, but you almost want to say it's easy to make money in this environment. Read the newspaper and then consider what it says, and then do it a week later, and the stock market seems to finally catch up to the news. It's been uncanny that the stock market just reacts to stuff that's 2 months old because they finally figure it out. Well, a lot of people have said, be that as it may, it got destroyed in January. It was one of the worst Januaries in history, and so therefore it's overdone. Valuations are reasonable. Time to buy. The chart here on the right, the big chart on the right, in orange is the current decline in the S&P 500 off of its October 9th, 2007 high. Yes, only 5 months ago we made an all-time high. And it compares it to its March 24th, 2000 high as far as where we were during the tech bubble as we unfolded from here. This market is actually down more than we were down at the comparable period in 2000. If you look at the top left chart, that compares it to the 73 high, and the bottom chart compares it to the 1937 high. These were all big, secular, multi-year bear markets. The current decline in this stock market is nothing that one would suggest is, in my mind, it's not been a complete wipeout, that the stock market is showing extraordinary value. If you believe that this is a secular bear market, and I'm kind of coming to that conclusion myself, then what you've seen over the last 5 months in the stock market is fairly typical of the beginning of a secular bear market. So the stock market, you could argue, still has a long way to go. Now, why could it be a secular bear market? Look at the chart on page 20. Here I show financial earnings as a percent of S&P 500 earnings, and I show energy earnings as a percent of S&P 500 earnings. Q4 numbers should be out shortly for this, but through Q3, 45% of all of the S&P's 500 earnings have come from two sectors, the financials and the energy. Financials, we've wiped out $200 billion in the financials. There's going to be a gigantic reversal in that sector as we move forward from here, and I think what you're going to see as we move forward from here is huge declines coming from that. Energy, 75% of all crude oil is produced by national oil companies. The profits that the oil companies make comes more from refining spreads than it comes from the gross level of crude oil. That's why energy earnings in 2007 only gained about 2% on a year-over-year basis, even though the price of crude oil went up 100%. Aramco and Venezuela and Mexico make the money when crude oil prices go up. The rest of them are really hoping that the price of gasoline, the spread between gasoline and heating oil and jet fuel to crude oil, or the refining margins widen, and they largely haven't been widening out. We're still stuck with a 3-handle on gasoline. We're not at a 4 or 5-handle on gasoline. So what I'm trying to bring up is that for those that think that the stock market presents good value, here's half your earnings and they're dead. You've got a reverse going on in financials, and you don't have an explosion of margins going on, refining margins going on in the energy sector. The charts on page 21, for time's sake, I'll try and wrap this up and just show you that these are the Fed's valuation models numbers, and a lot of people have looked at the Fed valuation models and said, hey, they say that stocks are cheap, but in this environment, they've been saying that for 5 years. Finally, the chart on page 22, and then I'll give you a conclusion and take some questions. The chart on page 22 shows the annual change in the CPI, headline CPI, and it shows the 10-year yield. Other than the brief spike in CPI following Hurricane Katrina, this is the first time since 1980 that the yield of the 10-year note is less than headline inflation. Bonds have no value in this environment. In fact, we've gone on to call them crash insurance. That's all they really are in this environment, is crash insurance. You buy them because you think there's problems with the larger financial system. If there isn't problems with the larger financial system, you sell them. So to give you a quick bottom line on where I think everything is, on the economy, I would argue that we are in month 3 of a recession. It started in December, January, February. March will be month 4. We had 0.6 GDP for the fourth quarter. Maybe that gets revised down. First quarter, consensus numbers are starting to look like it might be a negative. I'll go with that. It'll be a negative number. I have no reason to argue that otherwise, and that we are actually in a recession. I'm not using 2 negative quarters, but I'm saying that I don't think that's a tough call right now to say we're in a recession. The financial crisis is getting worse, not getting better. Home prices are halfway through their decline. If you go through the consensus forecast, it's already caused $200 billion worth of losses. We got another 10% down to go. The monoline insurers, just like the SIVs before them and the teaser freezer plan before it, looks like they're on course for the worst-case scenario. Whatever you think the worst-case scenario is, we look like we're going to do it. And the worst-case scenario looks like we're going to save the munis so Elliot Spitzer can line himself up to be president in 2012 or 2016 and let the banks write off everything, because we're not going to fund those sides deep enough, or they're going to have huge write-downs on that structured finance split in these companies. And they are going to have bigger write-downs, further impairments of capital. Asset-backed securities and structured finance markets are grinding to a halt right now. No deals are getting done. That's why interest rates are not going down, because you ultimately need buyers of this product in order to free up capital to get it moving. One of the things that I think has been causing mortgage rates to skyrocket in the last 2 weeks, in addition to just Treasury yields going up, is that most people have been warehousing mortgages to eventually sell them when the asset-backed market moves. They're running out of balance sheet to warehouse them. They can't sell off what they have to free it up in order to move more. Aurora Loans, which is loaned by Lehman Brothers, which is one of the largest originators, stopped taking on originations about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I think we're starting to see that happen. So the situation has the appearance to be getting worse. What saves this situation, by the way, is if home buyers appear this spring and we actually get a bottom in home prices. We'll have to wait and see if that happens. The stock market has been a lagging indicator. It doesn't understand a lot of these stories. And we've seen it react negatively to news after the fact. July, the credit markets were a disaster. They said, who cares? August, they figured it out, and the stock market tanked. We said that there would be large losses, we being the general community, that there was going to be large losses in the financial system for the fourth quarter. They said, who cares? When January came, the stock market tanked. So they've been behind the case. So to suggest that there's more losses coming, that there's a monoline worst-case scenario coming, it's consistent with what we've seen in the past as far as the stock market being slow to react to this stuff. So that kind of gives you a little bit of an idea of why I think we're so pessimistic on where we're going to go from here. Let me stop there. Let me give you instructions in order to ask some questions. You can also email me questions as well, too. In order to ask questions, it's £7 on your phone, so just £7 in pound, and you can get in the queue to ask questions. If you want to ask me a question via email, it's jbianco, J-B-I-A-N-C-O, at biancoresearch.com. Remember that we use first names only. We find that if people are a little bit more anonymous with their names, that they will ask more questions. With that, let me take the first question, which is an email question. And the email question comes from Michael, and he is asking if I had any comments on the FOMC minutes yesterday. And yes, I did. As we wrote this morning, I think that the FOMC minutes are basically telling us that the Fed is all about the stock market right now. They had an emergency meeting on January 9th. They had an emergency meeting on January 23rd. What was the commonality between both of those? In the prior week, the stock market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, was down almost 700 points in both cases. On the January 9th meeting, they decided not to cut rates. They had their meeting on January 21st, which was Martin Luther King holiday. The markets were closed. They knew, like everybody else, that there was a risk that the stock market was going to go down. Europe was down 8%. The futures were pointing down hundreds of points. They decided to cut rates and make the announcement an hour before the stock market opened. As much as Fed apologists want to huff and puff and pretend, the Fed right now has defined the credit crisis as being the level of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Credit spreads can be terrible. They're not going to do anything. The asset-backed securities market can be terrible. They're not going to do anything. But God forbid the stock market go down 500 or 600 points in a couple of days, and you're going to get yourself an ease out of the stock market. So I think that all this talk about inflation, and I think all this talk about rapid adjustments once the thing situates, I don't buy it. I don't think that they will rapidly adjust. If they go down to 2% on the funds rate or 2.5% on the funds rate, and the stock market starts screaming higher and everybody says that the problem is solved, the Fed will then say, well, we got to raise rates. But the Jim Cramers of the world are going to scream, don't you dare, you're going to create another bear market. And they're going to knuckle under, and the dollar will be under tremendous trouble. I think that right now they're not worried about that, but what they're really worried about is the economy in general, but they seem to react to the stock market in particular. That's one of the reasons why we've been so pessimistic about the Fed, or thinking that the Fed has not been doing things right. They've put their credibility on the line, and they've decided that their credibility for the moment is all about the stock market, and that's a big mistake. And I think the FOMC minutes confirm that with those two emergency meetings. Next email question, and then I'll jump into live questions, comes from Vincent. He asks, can you repeat your loss estimates on the monolines from page 14? The monolines are estimated to have about $600 billion worth of guarantees to the banking system. A lot of those guarantees are in the form of that the banks own municipals that have some form of monoline insurance. But away from that, the estimates from Barclays and UBS was that if there was a downgrade across the board of all of the monolines, that the banking system would take somewhere between $150 and a $200 billion loss. Now, why is that? They being the banking system, is sitting on CDOs that have either defaulted or are going into default, that these deals are coming apart. They have an insurance policy from a AAA-rated company that says that they're going to assume the payments. So the banks are correct. They do not have to assume a loss because they have a AAA-rated insurance policy on something that has a big loss. If they being the monolines, lose that AAA rating, then they have to start realizing portions of those losses depending on how far down their ratings go. In the worst-case scenario, if they cannot pay at all, then Then in the worst case scenario, if they do not pay at all, then I think at that point you're talking about $150 to $200 billion worth of losses. Nobody thought that that was a realistic option until the monoline split started to come down the pike. And by saying that we're going to put the muni business into one company and the structured finance business into another company, and DiNalo said over and over again before somebody set him straight, our goal is to protect the muni side. Well, we know what that means for the structured side. Now you start have to worry about the idea that there could be $150 to $200 billion worth of losses in the banking system. So with that as an answer, let me jump to some of the to some of the live questions here. And the first one is from Mark. Mark, are you with us?
Yeah, hi, Jim.
Hi.
I don't know if it's really a question or more of a comment. In the auction rate securities market in the municipal space, it seems to me it's more of a liquidity problem than a credit problem, simply from the standpoint of so many current investors trying to redeem those securities, get out of them at the same time. It's not that the underlying credits are bad, but that the, you know, the investment banks were unwilling to take on additional securities onto their balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the issuers can sort of turn those around and just term that debt out, you know, either 3 years or longer if they want to, and then sort of the pressure in that area sort of goes away. Just seems to me it was a mismatch in terms of investor demand and investment bank balance sheet.
Well, let me comment on that. I agree with you because one of the things that we've said is exactly that, is that I think that on the muni side, it's been overblown. Yeah, there's a problem on the muni side, but it's not catastrophic because these municipalities have underlying credit ratings, which aren't too bad. And that you're right, they can either term them out. I think it also shows that the investment banks have set up really bad structures with these auction rate securities, in that I know a number of people that have said, I want to jump in. If the Port Authority is offering me a 20% or 8% like they did yesterday, I want in. But it's not that easy to get in on these deals. And it's
right.
Very difficult to figure out who to call, what to do to get in so that you could start to bid on them. They set these structures up all bad so that they did not invite a lot of buyers into these. And then finally, I think that the problem with the muni side, and, you know, I'll be a little flippant in the argument, is, you know, Marcy Kapor, who's the congresswoman from Ohio, was the one who confused Bernanke with Paulson when she was criticizing Bernanke for being the former chairman of Goldman Sachs and didn't know who she was talking about. These are the people that get promoted from town manager and project manager to go to Congress, and they don't know the difference between Paulson and Bernanke. So when you're going to ask the mayor of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, or the head of the school district from Naperville, Illinois, you know, what's happening with your auction rate securities, they have no idea how to even explain those situations, and it's understandable that they would panic over the situation, not to just say, oh, well, we'll just term it out. So I understand the reason for the panic, but I don't understand that DiNalo and Spitzer and the Wisconsin State Insurance Commissioner Dulwig have to decide that they have to draw a line in the sand after one bad week of auction rate securities and say, this can't go on anymore, the hell with the banks. And that seems to be what they were doing right now, and I think that it's a very, very bad precedent to set, and they're going to regret it somewhere down the road. So did you have a follow-up to that, Mark?
No, that's a great point.
Okay, thanks a lot. Let me jump to the next question. Next one is Richard. Are you there? Going once, going twice.
Hello?
Dick, your line's open, yes.
Yeah. Let's say there's some other people on the conference call. There's George and Hank and Arnold. And they have they're placing the call and they're saying, Mr. Bianco, we agree with your conclusions. Tell us what to do. As President of the United States, Secretary of Treasury, and governor of a pretty big state, we buy your total analysis. What the heck do we do to fix it? And We haven't invited some of the other governors or regulators, but just with the three of us, tell us what to do. What's the critical point that could help turn this around?
Well, you mean other than resign?
Well, do you think that would help?
I think in the case of the Treasury Secretary, I've not been a big fan of his.
Could you kind of identify what you would have preferred to have been done as opposed to what he did and what you would recommend they do now?
Let me talk about the problem, of course, is that the monoline insurers wrote a bunch of policies that they should have never written, and they've got losses. The ultimate answer to this is going to be that we need some kind of a private sector bailout. I don't think a government bailout will work. If you look at what happened with Northern Rock, that's not a good situation, and we don't need to have Northern Rock Redux here with the monolines. The most likely scenario, I think, is you go to the sovereign wealth funds, and you tell them that we're going to need some money to bail these out. And when the sovereign wealth funds say, are you kidding me? I'm not going to put money anywhere near these companies. You tell them, fine. You know, if you can't, don't give me $10 billion for this now, and it's not $10 billion down the hole, maybe we'll get you something back. Your entire portfolio could lose a lot more later. Unfortunately, I think that's going to happen. I was going to say, I think that something like that's going to happen, but unfortunately, I think we're going to have to take the markets to a state of crisis to kind of focus everybody's mind. And at that point, once everybody's mind is focused, then I think we might find the money that these companies need. If you look back at the Dallo timeline, January 23rd, he huddled everybody in his office and said, we got to do something about these monolines. And the original story was that they were going to have a plan in place within 48 hours. Here it is, February 21st, and they still say they're at least a week away, because as the markets get better, no one has an appetite to give them money. So I do think that ultimately the problem is going to come in terms of once the mind gets focused with unstable markets, that there might be a real incredible plan to bail these out, and maybe from the sovereign wealth funds because they're the biggest pile of money. I think that if you were to ask me about the problems that the Treasury Secretary has done, I don't like all of his plans that have been basically to try and prevent. Home prices are overvalued. The best thing we can do is get them to the right value. Any plan to prevent them from going to the right value is just going to make it worse, not better. And by trying to make it worse, I think you've now got a problem where people are intentionally walking away from their homes. How do you solve that? Let's bottom out home prices as quickly as possible so we could tell them, look, whatever loss you have in your home, it's not getting any worse. It's only going to get better. But by putting together plans to freeze foreclosures for 30 days, you've just added another month to the decline in home prices, and it's going to make people's resolve to walk away even greater. If there was one thing he should have done, he should have pushed for more transparency. They should have pushed for a lot more transparency from the monolines to understand the deals that they have struck so that people could get a better understanding and handle on what they have. A lot of people learned about their deals from Ackman's open source disclosure 2 weeks ago. The monolines have been very slow in letting everybody know the true extent of their deal. So I would say, in essence, at this point, I don't know what they can do short of, I think a crisis is what's going to focus the mind. And short of a crisis, if markets stay together, we're going to just endlessly talk about this. And I think if there was something they could have done and should have done is they could have forced more transparency on the market so people could get a better understanding of the extent of the problem so that it truly can get discounted. One of the reasons why the stock market has such a delayed reaction in all this bad news is they don't understand it, and it's understandable. But maybe if you make them understand it, we get this problem behind us. I don't know, Dick, did you have any disagreements with that, or what's your thought?
No, that's fine. I think that the German finance minister doubling the estimate of the subprime was perhaps a governmental step pushing forward recognition of losses.
I would definitely agree with that they need to not be afraid to say that there is a problem. You know, it's kind of like the Fed, to just kind of, you know, put a parallel track there. The Fed is going to cut the funds rate to 2.5, and they've got this forecast that they've now downgraded. that we're going to have like 1% growth in the first half of the year and 3% growth in the second half of the year to average roughly 2 for the year. And my comment there was, you know, come on, tell us what you really think, because if your forecast is right and we have 4% inflation and we jump to 3% growth in the third quarter with a 2.5% funds rate, we've created a whole other crisis. And we know you don't believe that because your actions with the funds rate suggest otherwise. So tell us what you really think instead of trying to sugarcoat this by saying, yeah, you think we're going to slip by a recession and stuff like that. So I think that you're right with the German finance minister, with the Fed, and with everybody else, at least start to say it. Paulson, I will give him credit, though. He has in the last 10 days or so started to say that the worst part of the home price decline still might be ahead of us. And that, I think, he's trying to say the second 10% down is still coming. And he's been saying that. And but I still think people are not really getting it. Any other follow-ups? Thoughts? Nope. I guess he jumped off.
Nope, that's fine.
Oh, thanks, Dick. Jump to the next question, and this is from Jeffrey. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, hi there, Jim. I don't want to change the topic too much, but question. The energy market. We're kind of in a situation bumping heads against $100 again, and one way or the other, we're going to end up breaking out of kind of this $14, $15 range you've been in for a while. And given the fact that a week or two ago, I think Howard wrote a piece about the so-called lack of correlation, he thought, with stock market prices and the energy market and crude, if let's just assume that energy prices do move up, and quite substantially. We go up to $115, $120 or whatever. What's your take on the reading through that and how the markets, especially the equity market, might react to that situation?
You know, right now, we did a piece yesterday about energy, and that if you look at the statistics, there really isn't a good correlation at all between energy prices in the S&P 500, in that if I was to give you a roadmap, you know, the way we like to explain, I like to explain it is if I was to give you a roadmap, here's a chart of the next 2 years of energy prices, go trade stocks, you can't do it, and you haven't been able to do it. So at least at a general level, the energy prices, I think at this point, are an unknown factor on the stock market because nobody thought 5 years ago if we got to $100 oil that we'd be at 12,000 on the Dow, and that's exactly what's happened right now. As far as moving forward from here, I think that a lot of people are now starting to look at energy prices. They're in a confusing kind of way. I mean, some have suggested that $100 oil is a sign of global growth, which is what's keeping those prices high. Some have started to scream that it's actually more of an issue of peak oil and that supplies are being restricted, which is really what's keeping it up as well. I tend to kind of more go towards the global growth story in that, you know, if you were to ask me, why do we have $99 oil today versus $30 5 years ago, I'd say, you know, look at the growth in China, look at the growth in India, more than look at what's been happening in the United States. And that ultimately, if we get a bad enough recession to kill their economies, that you could definitely bring crude oil prices down. But that's almost where we are right now, is that it is a sign of global growth, not necessarily U.S. growth, even though I do think the U.S. is in recession. It's really more about China, and it's really more about India. And as far as the problem for investors when it comes to oil, if you're trying to model oil as to what does it mean for financial markets or credit spreads or the stock market, it's been very, very difficult. We've even gone as far to say that if you were to try and model crude oil, we can't even find a good way to model crude oil to tips break even spreads. And that seems to be a conclusion that everybody accepts, that inflation-protected securities have somewhat of a relationship to the price of crude oil, and we've even disagreed with that. So crude oil, I think, is the bottom line is it's a global growth story. It will continue to stay where it is right now unless or until we see a real slowdown in global growth. Did you have a follow-up or a comment about that?
No, I think I read your piece yesterday, and I understood it quite frankly, and I guess My personal hunch is that yes, that if the prices would move up quite significantly, that if, regardless of the justification and reasoning behind it, and even if it is the demand situation in the rest of the world, that the stock market might not take that so nicely. It seems what you're suggesting is that it's difficult to quantify or forecast, given that the correlation has not really been there in the past. If it happens, it's going to be more of a coincidental thing. I guess my take on it would be it's also going to be, it might produce a psychological drag on the market and potentially on the dollar as well.
I have a story here from late 2000. It's an economist story that talks about whether or not high energy prices are going to slow down world growth. And in late 2000, energy prices hit $28 a barrel. And they were starting to, and now here we are in 2008 at $100 a barrel, and we're still waiting for that to happen. In theory, you're right. There is a level supposedly high enough if we go up there that it's going to really impact global growth. In practicality, I don't know if it's 105 or 1,005 or where in between that number is. And so, you know, you like I said, you don't know where it could wind up going. But the only thing you can say is if we get an unexpected supply shock, a real and major unexpected supply shock on the level of the 70s, then you could say, well, whatever level we're at, then this would be something that would be negative. But we don't have that unexpected and significant supply shock. We've really had more of a demand pull to get energy prices up to these levels. So it's been a difficult one because we recognize its importance and we get frustrated, we being the market in general, by saying $100 crude oil must mean something, and we just can't quite figure out what it means.
Right? Yeah, so, yeah, gotcha. No, thanks a lot.
Sure, thank you. Let me conclude. I've gotten a lot of emailed questions, and a lot of them are about the monolines. And let me take these in order. And for those of you that have been asking these questions, I think that I'll try and answer them in detail a little bit more. The reinsurance category on the charts on page 14 include all of the reinsurers, the Munich Re's, the Zurich Re's, the Berkshires, the Lloyd's, the syndicates, and even a lot of the monoline reinsurers like the Channel Re's and stuff like that. So everybody's in that category as well, too. Somebody asked, how long would a monoline split take? That's a good question because the banks are not going to sit around and allow this to happen. Bank of America had a piece a couple of days ago, which I agree with, which suggested we'd have the mother of all lawsuits that would come down on this, because absolutely we would, because we're talking about as much money as the tobacco settlements here, and they're going to throw as much resources at this lawsuit to not allow the insurance companies to split as they would with the tobacco lawsuits. And the other thing I would mention about the split, the insurance industry, I think, would be very much in favor of allowing the monolines to split, because once you set that precedent, I'm sure they would love then to turn around and say, you know, all these asbestos claims that we've been choking on, or these lead paint claims we've been choking on, I think we should split them off into their own company and not fund that properly, too, and let that die and protect all of our other shareholders. How about the next time we have a big hurricane hit Florida or the Panhandle? Why don't we just say, okay, well, let's take all of those claims and put them together in its own separate company and not fund that properly? Now, those are a little bit of extreme examples, but that's the precedent that you'd be setting up. So, yeah, I could see that the insurance company would be in favor of it, but I don't necessarily see where the where everybody else would be in favor of it. Lastly, the argument, and this is a bunch of questions I was just thumbing through here. Let me ask the question this way and then answer. Why are people like Marty Whitman at Third Avenue and Warburg Pincus and Chris Davis at Davis Selected being huge investors in these monoline companies? I think what they're arguing is, if you look at these policies are not like your traditional credit default swap that when a CDO goes into default, you put it upon the monoline and they pay you back par. That's not how these policies are written. These policies are written that the monoline will assume the payment stream from that point forward. And some of these policies also have in them that the monoline gets to decide when they get to assume the payment stream, and in some cases they might be able to put it off for years before they actually pay. That sounds like a pretty bullish argument that we've overstated the case. However, I think the fact that the Moody's is in S&P and Fitch are either downgrading them or threatening to downgrade them, and that the market is starting to worry about them. And if you look to lead paint and asbestos, remember, these are insurance companies now, so there's your precedent, is that in any kind of litigation with the wording on those policies, they usually tend to be favored towards the policyholder. So while the monoline may have a policy that says, look, we only assume the payment, we don't have the bonds or the structure put upon us and give them back par, and we can decide that default takes place 3 years from today and then just assume a cash flow payment for the next 40 years before we actually have to come up with par, so we don't need that much capital to cover these. The fact of the matter is, once you start litigating it, it could turn out to be a whole different ball of wax, and that's been the case with a lot of these as well, too. So it is a very, very difficult to understand situation that continually evolves. Call has been going on about 71 minutes. I'll end it here. Thank everybody for joining us. If you have any other questions, I'll try and answer them via email or telephone call. If anybody else wants to discuss any of the issues here in greater detail, give me a call or send me an email. Otherwise, we'll see everybody next month. So thank you for joining us, and bye-bye.